From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one of the key constituencies for the Democratic Party faces a decision in a U.S. Senate race.
More conservative black voters, they're definitely showing up to the polls. Those are the high propensity Wayne County voters. Haley is outspending Abdul, I believe, 6 or 7 to 1 at this point.
Also, the White Stripes anthem that became a global sports phenomenon.
I think that what they were surprised by, number one, was that people were chanting the song, but it wasn't the lyrics, it was the riff.
And today, The Dish visits a UP fish market that's been serving up the freshest for 5 generations.
It's hard work, you know. You have to persevere through rough times, and you go out there and get, if you get 1,000 pounds, you're good. If you get 300 pounds, that's good too.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Hope you're staying safe out there and keeping away from the smoke as much as you possibly can. Today on the show, what it took for a beloved UP fish market to go the distance.
Local people around here, they're so good to us.
So supportive.
Yeah, they're so supportive. They always come. I mean, we couldn't make it without the local people around here.
That's coming up later in the hour, but first, voters in Michigan are making important decisions about primary races. If you're a vote-by-mail person, you may already have a ballot in your hand. We've got, among other things, a very competitive race in the Democratic primary for an open U.S. Senate seat this fall. Republican candidate Mike Rogers will be the likely person to face the Democratic primary winner in November. Voters in our state's biggest city, which is chock full of Democratic voters, have a big decision in front of them now. Reporter Sam Robinson at the Michigan Chronicle has been talking to them about this race. Hey, Sam, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April. Thanks for having me.
So the options in the Senate primary, the two front runners are Haley Stevens and Abdul Al-Sayed. Detroiters might have reasons to know something about those names just out of hand based on the jobs that they've held. Can you explain a little bit about how Detroiters might have encountered them?
Yeah, well, you know, Detroiters may have encountered Haley Stevens long ago. She likes to tout that her dad owned a business. He owns like a landscaping business. And, you know, he's still got his Stevens landscaping on the side of his truck, she says. Haley, of course, is from Birmingham.
Not Detroit, right.
Sure. She spent a lot of time in Detroit, Metro Detroit. She exists in the Metro Detroit media market and is, of course, the U.S. representative representing the 11th Congressional District. Abdul Al-Sayed is the former Detroit and Wayne County Health Director. He took over the Detroit Health Department when it came back. It was privatized, remember, and then it came back under city rule. He, of course, was the Wayne County Health Director as the county was sort of shifting its juvenile care from that really bad Hamtramck facility. He left seemingly to run for U.S. Senate. That has been part of the criticism against him. Haley Stevens came into Congress in 2018 and 2022, defeated Andy Levin. And who helped her? The organizations, the groups that supported her then are supporting her now. And that is a huge part of this narrative that outside groups, lobbies like AIPAC and others, corporate interests are backing Stevens. Al-Sayed is the sort of grassroots, no corporate money, pro-Palestine, anti-Israel candidate.
So do you find that Abdul Al-Sayed, his positions as health director for first the city and then the county, that's not an elected position, but it is, you know, a position of some public recognition. Do you find a lot of people know his name?
No. You know, in my neighborhood on the east side off Whittier over here, Yorkshire Woods, Outer Drive Hayes, not a lot of people are familiar with Abdul Al-Sayed. Some people tell me that they've been seeing his advertisements. He, like Haley Stevens, does have digital ads and television ads playing. Stevens is, of course, outspending Abdul, which means her face, her advertisements are on people's TVs a lot more than they've seen Abdul Al-Sayed. The big story from the ads, of course, is what people are telling me. They say, well, Obama is with Haley Stevens, so you know I'm going to be with Haley Stevens too. Obama did endorse Haley Stevens in 2018, has not endorsed her since. Those clips are 10 years old that groups that back her are paying. And it's been an effective strategy. People tell me that, you know, they're going with wherever Obama goes. Some of those people know that Obama has not endorsed her. many more are assuming this false idea that Obama did endorse her against Abdul Al-Sayed in the race. That is not true.
So I have to say, when I saw the headline on your story that the Obama support is helping her, I was like, wait a minute, did he endorse in the Senate race? Because, I mean, that would be a pretty huge development. He is still very widely and well-regarded in Detroit. But yeah, the ads, am I right that the ads don't really make it clear that that quote is from 2017, entirely different campaign cycle?
Well, it depends who you ask. Of course, the Al-Sayed supporters are going to say it's completely misleading and they're intentionally trying to dupe Black voters in Detroit into believing that Obama endorsed her campaign. Now, when you ask Haley Stevens supporters, like Wayne County Commissioner, Chair of the 13th District, Jonathan Kinlock, you know, he says that none of these ads were meant to misinform people or mislead people. They're just frankly doing what other candidates would do. I mean, it is a pretty common thing. And of course, even a guy like Bernie Sanders in 2020, I mean, he in an advertisement put himself next to Barack Obama, despite not having Barack Obama's endorsement in that race. We've seen Obama be used. There's this sort of conversation underbelly that's like, well, if Obama really had a problem with these ads, wouldn't he go to the whoever? And, you know, he's invoked so much in our American political arena all across the United States that I don't know if he could, if he would. Dave Weigel is a reporter for the national website Semaphore. He confirmed through Obama's office, he reports. I reached out to Obama's office, quote unquote. I didn't get a response back. But Dave Weigel says that Obama's office reiterates the fact that Obama has not endorsed in this race. The former president has really stayed quiet. He's stayed out of a lot of these hotly contested Democratic primary races.
Sure. Sam, who would you say are the Detroit voters most likely to show up for elections, either in person on primary voting day or getting those ballots in? But we know that a lot of times the midterms don't get anywhere near the turnout that the presidential election every 4 years does. I just kind of wonder if there's much overlap between people who may have an opinion on the Senate race and who's actually going to vote.
That's part of the conversations that I was having last weekend at the African World Festival, talking to younger folks. There's this one girl, she said, I'm definitely going to go vote. And she recognized that it's going to be an uphill battle for her to convince her friends to definitely go vote. She said that some of her friends are aware of Abdul's campaign, but she isn't sure that they have a plan yet to vote. Haley Stevens' base, which to me, based on my observations, consists of the older, sort of more conservative Black voters, they're definitely showing up to the polls. Those are the high propensity Wayne County voters. And so Abdul's team has to do these GOTV, get out the vote, information sessions, got to tell people, hey, if you already voted for Mallory McMurrow, here's how you spoil your ballot. I see Haley Stevens' campaign doing that as well. That's kind of a wild card in this race that not a lot of people are talking about, that Mallory's name is going to remain on the ballot. Mallory McMurrow, she's a state senator from Royal Oak. She, of course, dropped out. She was trying to run to the middle of Abdul and Haley. There is no middle of this issue of corporate influence or the influence of the Israeli lobby. There just seems to be in the Democratic Party a group of people that are on the side of, we got to end this, we got to curb corporate spending, and we got to diminish the influence of Israel in our politics. And there's a side that doesn't feel that way.
Yeah. Would you say, just as someone who lives in Detroit and occasionally has the TV on or like looking through your feeds, would you say that the ad buys are pretty hot and heavy now with just a couple of weeks left before ballots are due and in-person voting happens?
Yeah. I mean, voters are getting flooded with messages. Haley is outspending Abdul, I believe, 6 or 7 to 1 at this point. There's been reporting, Ad Impact is a research and advertisement research firm. They have reported that there is more than $40 million being pumped by AIPAC-adjacent groups connected to AIPAC or funded by AIPAC. They're spending upwards of $50 million in this Michigan Senate race. You know, this is like historic funding of this type of race. We saw it in the Louisiana congressional race that included Thomas Massie, who was defeated. He was the anti-Israel Republican that AIPAC spent a lot of money against. And so AIPAC has a really strong track record when they want things to go their way, they pretty much just spend as much money as it takes to make it happen.
Voters who feel really strongly about Abdul El-Sayed's candidacy have a range of issues on their minds. Some of them really like him because his stances on healthcare, which as an MD, you know, this is something he's talked a lot about. It's a big priority. Others say, you know, if this guy is good enough that Bernie Sanders will endorse him, he's good enough for me. And there are some people for whom the key issue is Gaza, Iran, Lebanon, these foreign policy entanglements that have meant catastrophic loss of life as the U.S. and its allies have pursued military goals. Would you say when you talk to Detroiters on the street, you mentioned the one woman at the African World Festival that you spoke with, but are those kinds of foreign policy issues something that a lot of people brought up when asked about what's motivating them?
Yeah. Yeah, even the people that you wouldn't expect. I talked to a pair of Haley Stevens voters. Their names are DW and Donna Mills. That tweet, including those folks, blew up because they're telling me that, and you can hear it in the Otter recording. I posted the audio of our conversation. The criticism against the Israeli government, despite being Stevens voters, is something that bewildered a lot of the El-Sayed folks that were like, they should be voting for us. There are people who have, you know, nuanced, complex takes on what is happening in Israel that don't necessarily fall into the sort of leftist or, you know, super progressive, wherever Abdul El-Sayed finds himself on the political spectrum. He says he's not DSA. DSA will not be voting to endorse him. The Metro Detroit DSA group confirmed that to me last week. But yeah, I mean, the foreign policy issue, more Black elders are aware of it than I think, you know, the national media would play, usually younger Arab folks or younger white activists, advocates are the ones that are talking about that issue. And I hear a lot of people say, you know, that's not our fight. And so, yeah, you do hear both sides of the coin when you talk to sort of the average Detroit voter.
Sam Robinson. You can read his clips at the Michigan Chronicle. And like the man said, he's also a really good follow on the socials. Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, April.
Let's break for just a moment. When we come back, the seven notes the whole world knows.
It's almost a unique situation to just have people chanting a guitar riff like that.
The director of a short film about the White Stripes and the sports world's number one anthem joins us in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend, we'll all be rooting for the final game of the World Cup. In fact, a large swath of the world will be watching as Argentina and Spain face off Sunday afternoon. And at some point, more than a billion people all around the world may lift their voices in harmony and sing this hymn. I'm gonna fight them all. A seven-nation army couldn't hold me back. Not the whole song, probably. Just these seven notes. If you've ever watched or attended a sporting event in an arena over the past 20 years, you've heard this song. Of course, it is Seven Nation Army, written by Detroit's own Jack White. It's not only cemented his rock legend status, it has arguably made the most well-known riff in history.
If you have like 8 billion people on the planet now, and soccer is the most widely famous sport in this planet, everybody and their brother has at least heard this melody, if not chanted it themselves.
That was Jack White speaking in a mini documentary, The Most Famous Seven Notes in Sports. It debuted with ESPN this week, and Mike Farrell was the producer of the piece. Mike, welcome to Stateside. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I can only guess at how many times Jack White has been asked to talk about Seven Nation Army as a sports anthem. Was it hard to convince him?
I'm not sure if it was hard to convince him. It took a lot of time to get the interview on the books, a lot of back and forth. But I just tried to make a pitch to them that I felt was authentic to Jack, authentic to the White Stripes, kind of like a holistic pitch of like wanting the piece to take on the feel and the look and the sound of the band itself. And I hope because it was authentic, that might have been the main selling point to make sure that Jack was on board with it. I'm a huge music fan. I've played guitar for almost 30 years myself. And so it was a perfect kind of combination of sports and music. And maybe I was in the right place at the right time.
Jack White is nothing if not thoughtful about presentation. And you know, the whole look of the White Stripes and his solo projects and other bands that he's been involved in, the whole ethos of Third Man. What do you mean when you say you were trying to communicate to him that this would be true to what the White Stripes were about?
Well, just that I was a fan of the band for a long time. You know, I went to see them as a 20-something person back in the early 2000s, and I love the band. So I feel like I had an understanding of the band. I wasn't some kind of outsider coming in to do a project about a band that I didn't understand. But, you know, further to that, you know, just little details that we tried to bring into the piece that were true to the band, whether it be using the same font that was used on the Elephant album, the backwards three, you know, which obviously the band has utilized, and the color scheme of red, black, and white. Just trying to pay attention to those details, you know, something that is super subtle that people might not notice, but like the song itself is in the key of E minor and the entire piece is scored in the key of E minor. So just trying to pay attention to those little details that, you know, maybe Jack would appreciate, some people might not notice, but to me it was important that we kind of try to intentionally produce every aspect of this story.
Yeah. What did Jack White tell you about when he first realized that his song, this anthem, was being played and sung in sports arenas at such a scale?
Yeah, I mean, the way he tells it, like I kind of framed it as like a bit of an underdog story, like the song itself. It wasn't something that was revered as this like special work of genius instantaneously, you know, even by Jack himself. He kind of said he thought it was all right. They didn't spend a lot of time on it, recording it. You know, Ben Swank, who is a business partner of Jack's now and longtime friend, like famously had a ho-hum reaction to the riff the first time he heard it. So it wasn't this like, you know, stroke of genius that everyone was revering from the very beginning. He, I think, got wind of it around the 2006 World Cup when the Italian national team sort of adopted this song. They went on to win the World Cup, and it was being chanted in the streets of Rome and the streets of Florence and all over Italy. It became a bit of a cultural phenomenon, and him and Meg got wind of it at that time. And I think that what they were surprised by, number one, was that people were chanting the song, but it wasn't the lyrics, it was the riff, the guitar riff. And I think that especially was surprising to them, just in the sense that, like, you know, people maybe chant, you know, ole, 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 or lyrics of some song, but it's almost a unique situation to just have people chanting a guitar riff like that. And I think that's what struck them.
Yeah. Did you ask him about the first time he personally heard it at an arena at a game?
Not necessarily the first time, but there have been occurrences where he has been in the building and it's been chanted. There was one that I found from actually a Melbourne soccer match in 2024, which was held just down the street from the Melbourne hotel, the corner hotel where he actually wrote the riff, which is kind of crazy. So he was in the building, fans were chanting it. I know it's happened at Dodger games. He's a big baseball fan. So he said it's sort of surreal. He said that it almost is like looking at old pictures of your kids, is what he said. It kind of takes him back to a place in time when he came up with this riff, you know, in 2002, 2003. Yeah, and he also said too, like, it reminded him of the movie Yankee Doodle Dandy. And there's a scene where a famous songwriter, I think the song was called Over There, that he referenced, and that a young boy turns to the man who wrote the song, not knowing that he wrote it, saying, "Don't you know this song, old timer?"
"What's the matter, old timer? Don't you remember this song?" Seems to me I do.
And Jack was imagining and waiting for a scenario one day where that might happen to him at a sporting event.
Right.
And people not knowing that he was the one that composed this iconic piece of music. But what I loved about it too, and I wanted to kind of get this into the doc, I don't think it ended up in there, but he loves the fact that it is sort of anonymous now in a way, right? Like he doesn't want people to know that it's a White Stripes song. He would rather it be a song of the people in the folk music tradition, right? So people chanting it, not knowing the name of the song, not knowing who wrote it, just knowing the melody, that really is folk music. And I think that's what he likes about it. And I think that's awesome too.
Mike, when any trend takes over in public consciousness, you know it has to start with one person somewhere. But it also feels like trying to figure out that patient zero for pop culture yeah. trends is nearly impossible. I will say that in the doc, you really got to the heart of it with a specific group of football fans from Belgium. Can you talk about the fans in Bruges for that team and what year this took you back to?
Yeah, so I think it is rare with something, with a trend of this magnitude to actually be able to find the starting point for it. But we were able to find this group of soccer fans in Bruges, fans of a club called Club Bruges. And not only were we able to find the people that started it, it was unique that we were able to find a specific game, a specific moment where it began, which was an October 22nd, 2003 match between AC Milan and Club Bruges. Club Bruges was a heavy underdog in this game. AC Milan was the defending Champions League winners, a team that was stacked with Hall of Fame soccer players. And Club Bruges really had no business going in there winning this game, but they pulled off a miraculous 1-0 upset. And at the time, Seven Nation Army was kind of coming out. I think it had been out for a few months at that point. And so the Club Bruges fans had heard the song in the pub, you know, before the match. They kind of took it with them to the stadium. And then when they scored and they won, it just was a spontaneous occurrence. They started chanting it. And I was able to actually find like the raw audio that because this game was on ESPN way back in 2003, we not only had the game, but we had a clean audio feed of the game without any announcers. And so I scrubbed through the whole game waiting to try to hear where I could like hear the chant happening. And I was finally able to find it in the 87th minute. It was audible on the broadcast, which was so cool. And I kind of sent a chill down my spine when I eventually found it. I'm like, oh my God, there it is. Like, that's like the first time that this kind of happened. And it's like, we have the recording, we have it, and you can draw it back to Patient Zero, which I think is an interesting analogy. You know, as someone had described this riff to me as an invasive species kind of in your mind, which is true, right? Like anyone that hears it, like even all my family that I've shown the piece to, they end up singing it all day long afterwards. So it was very kind of fun detective work, producing work, to try to find where this began and to actually find the source of it.
What did your director brain do when you realized you'd found them?
I'd read that the story, you know, the sort of origin story, there was a few articles written about this game and this team, but I had never actually heard the audio myself. And I tell this to a lot of, you know, junior producers that I speak with. I always try to look at my presentations as like, I'm a lawyer and I need to prove my case to the audience. And so when I found that piece of audio, it was like, you know, a piece of evidence that was like crucial to the case, if you will. And so it really, you know, I had a huge smile on my face. And like I said, I had a chill kind of go down my spine that I had found it, because that was like the key proof. Like, you know, we always say show, don't tell in the documentary business. And you have, you know, a lot of people telling you that this happened, but now we were finally able for the first time to show that that's what happened and you can hear it for yourself, which I thought was awesome.
Yeah. Does this one group of fans in Belgium have an awareness now of how crazy it is that they were at the creation of what would become a global anthem?
Yeah, for sure they do.
Somebody just went, whoa, and it started like,
oh. So we were there in the stadium singing that song.
Club Bruges pulled off a 1-0 upset. And from that moment, that song became their song.
You know, one of the fans, Hirt, I'm probably saying his name wrong, but lovely, lovely guy. He described it quite eloquently, you know, as mixed feelings that they have, because they kind of feel like in one way, you know, they started it, they kind of own it. But in another way, they feel proud that they were, you know, the beginning point for this global phenomenon, right? So it was funny as well, in part of our interviews, Ben Swank, who I previously mentioned, who's an executive at Third Man Records, he talked about how every team in every city seems to kind of feel ownership of this riff. Like, oh, we're the ones that chant it. Like, we do that here in Miami or in Baltimore or in Penn State or at Michigan. Like, we're the ones that do that. But the reality is that the song kind of belongs to everyone in that tradition of folk music that we previously discussed. So, yes, the Bruges fans are aware of it. I think they feel a mixture of pride and a little bit of, like, you know, watching like a young kid almost go off to college and leave the house almost, and it goes on to take on a life of its own. And Jack, you know, I'm sure feels the same way about it. So, but they were very gracious hosts when we were there. In Bruges, it's an incredibly beautiful place, and I do think they feel a degree of pride that they were the ones that started this.
Mike, I have to tell you, it sort of blew my mind that the trend didn't start in Michigan. I mean, I've heard it played when the Tigers are playing. It is a staple at University of Michigan football games. The Lions use this. I just kind of figured that the connection between the band and the major sports teams here, both professional and collegiate, had to be something to do with it. Were you very surprised to know that the genesis was in Belgium, overseas?
I mean, it did feel kind of random, you know, for sure. Like, why would this not start in Detroit? Why would this not start in Michigan? Why was it, you know, Belgian soccer fans? I think that's part of what I liked about it too, though, right? It's like unexpected. I do think it's part of the reason for that, though, might be the fact of like chanting and its role at a sporting event. I think in major North American team sports, it's certainly not as common to have chants and songs sung. It's a uniquely soccer kind of cultural thing, and even more so in Europe, right? Like they really lean into that during the games and the different chants and songs that they sing. And so the fact that it kind of spawned over in Europe might seem unexpected geographically, but I think culturally it makes sense because it's so much more a part of the sport and part of the stadium experience to have these songs and chants over there than maybe it is in North America.
Yeah. One of the things I loved most about the experience of watching the mini doc was just getting to see Jack White wondering at the possibilities of this thing being the most famous melody in history, maybe. I mean, I don't know. You've also got da 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 and da 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 da. But I do think this is a compelling argument the way the global sports community has picked it up. I don't know. What do you think? Where did you come away from this project on that question?
It's such a fascinating thing to think about. I love it. I love the conversation because it's not something you're ever going to be able to prove for sure. You know, certainly people have talked about Happy Birthday, right? Like, but then you go into the question of like, well, is Happy Birthday like culturally relevant in like all countries and all languages? And it's not, right? So you're like, okay, well, maybe that's a ding against Happy Birthday, or like something like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, like the alphabet song, right? It's like, well, does that, like, not all languages use the same alphabet? Does that melody cut across? You know, I don't know. Like, sports and soccer in particular is really one of the few global, truly global things that transcends language, transcends culture. And I also think because of the simplicity of this melody, it's only seven notes, right? Like you hummed like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, right? It's like, I as famous as that is, I would probably argue that more people would recognize Seven Nation Army than Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It's just there's an accessibility to it because it's sports, because it's rock music. It's not classical music. There doesn't have to be a degree of sophistication associated with accessing it or listening to it. I think there's a compelling argument to be made that it might be the most recognized melody of all time. No one will ever be able to prove that, but it's a fun thing to talk about and think about.
Mike Farrell is a senior feature producer with ESPN and the creator of the mini doc, The Most Famous Seven Notes in Sports, which you can now find on YouTube. Mike, so nice talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Taking that time right behind my back.
And I'm talking to myself at night because I can't forget. We need to take a short break here. When we come back, we head to a special place in the UP where smoking fresh Lake Superior whitefish is a way of life. That's in a moment. You're with Stateside. And a message coming from my eyes says, leave it alone. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've ever driven through the UP, you know it's full of hidden gems. And Peterson's Fish Market in Hancock is one of those places. Mercedes Mejia, the host of The Dish, is here to tell us more.
Think about the freshest fish you've ever eaten. What did it taste like? What was the texture? Do you know where it came from?
That's so good. Crispy. I've never had fish this fresh. I don't know that I've had whitefish. But this is very good.
Wow. I've never had whitefish that tasted like that.
I have fish or whitefish or anything, and it tastes fishy, it's old. That's your key right there. If it has a fishy taste, then it's old. Same with smelling it.
So what we're eating now is probably from, yesterday, this morning?
Yeah. Yes, from yesterday.
It's as fresh as it gets.
In Michigan's Upper Peninsula, where all roads point to Lake Superior and the pine trees stand tall, three women are carrying a tribal fishing tradition into their fish market and fry house.
I'm Tammy Peterson. I do a little bit of everything here. Cook, fillet, smoke fish, clean, everything.
I'm Pat Peterson. I am the owner along with Tammy. She's partners with me. And I oversee everything.
I'm Tammy Peterson, and I help manage the restaurant, and then I work in the fish market when they need me to.
And yes, there are two Tammies.
And she does everything, too.
Oh, God, yeah.
Everything.
She does everything.
Everything. Secretarial, everything.
Their story is about family and tradition and the work behind truly fresh whitefish.
It's fresh.
Sometimes we're filleting in the market. The boys bring in the fish. We fillet it and we run it out here to them to cook. Because they say, hurry up, we need more fish.
We're calling and they're going, hurry, I need fish now. I need six baked fish now.
This is The Dish, a podcast telling Michigan's food stories one dish at a time. I'm Mercedes Mejia. Today, we bring you the story behind Peterson's Fish Market. To understand how this place came to be and why freshness is their North Star, you have to go back to the beginning. Producer Ronia Kavansag tells us more about the women behind this legacy and the community they've built around fishing, family, and the water.
Pat Peterson grew up in northern Wisconsin.
The Bayfield, Wisconsin area. So is my husband. We're both from the same reservation.
Her husband's family has been commercial fishing there for several generations.
Fifth or sixth. Oh. Yeah, I'd say five generations that go back commercial fishing. The entire Peterson family is in fishing, not just us. Uncles and cousins and, up in northern Wisconsin, the name Peterson's
synonymous with fishing.
Yeah, with fishing, yeah.
She's the matriarch of this whole operation. But to local regulars, she's Grandma Pat. She wears large wire-rimmed glasses and a bright pinkish red lip. Her gray hair is cropped short. And despite being endlessly busy, she exudes a sense of calm. Maybe that comes with life on the water.
It's beautiful going out on the water in the mornings when the sun's coming up and it's calm. And You know, you're standing in that gangway and the wind's blowing on you, and it's just real peaceful, you know. And then when you're out there working, you don't have time to look out the gangway at all. You're just busy, you know, getting the product, and you're hoping, oh, look at all the fish.
Pat and her husband are members of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa out of Wisconsin. For decades, there were legal battles over what exactly the Chippewa were allowed to do on Lake Superior based on an 1854 treaty. But in the 1970s, a court ruling definitively affirmed the band's right to fish on Lake Superior.
We thought we'd come here for a few years and then go back home. Well, we just stayed. You know, we ended up staying, and then my kids love it here and found their wives here and kind of love them, I guess.
Those two wives, by the way, are the two Tammies. Both of them are Pat's daughters-in-law. Together, they've created a new fishing community here in Michigan.
Our tribe, you had to decide. You either fish Michigan or you fish Wisconsin. We decided to do Michigan, and we've been here forever, it seems like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we're here fishing and supplying fish to everyone in the community and outside the community too, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Petersons run two operations out of Hancock on the Keweenaw Peninsula. One is the fish market, where they fillet and sell fresh catch. This one came first, about 34 years ago.
When you fish commercially, your product is just shipped to a fish buyer. Well, when you're only getting like less than 50 cents a pound for your fish, you have to make more money. And so we wanted to cut out the middleman. So we bought this little tiny building, the four of us, her and I and my husband and her husband. We started with nothing, you might as well say, and started building the business. And it just grew over the years, you know. But we started out small, and we scraped and scrounged, I'll tell you, for many years, eh?
Yeah, yeah. And our local people around here, they're so good to us,
mm-hmm.
Hey?
So supportive.
Yeah, they're so supportive. They always come. We couldn't make it without the local people around here. They're really good to us. They come all the time.
Peterson's Fish Market supplies fresh whitefish, salmon, and lake trout by the pound. But you can also pick up freshly smoked fish.
Can we see the smoker?
Oh, yeah.
Everything is filleted in the back of the building and cooked in a big smoker out front.
That fish is, like, golden. It's like a big black closet. And then there's the fire at the bottom.
Do you have to use, like, a specific kind of wood?
Yeah, hard maple.
Okay.
Hard maple is what we use. That's all we've ever used. And people come in and say, well, I got some apple wood if you want it. No. If it's not broke, you don't fix it.
The restaurant, Four Sons Fish and Chips, came later. Today, the team is about 27 people in total. A lot of them are family, and many are friends their kids grew up with.
All our kids worked here, and their friends. Everybody's worked here, so.
Believe me, it's not always pleasant.
Yeah.
We argue, we fight, we make each other cry.
You go home.
I quit.
And then we come back.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
But when the Petersons first came to the Keweenaw from Wisconsin, the reception wasn't so warm.
Is that just because of protectiveness over the lake, or?
Because we're Native American. There was big controversy when we came here. It wasn't easy in the beginning, you know, because they didn't want us here, us Wisconsin fishermen, because a lot of the people here said, this is our lake, this is our fish, and you don't belong here, go back home.
So, are you talking about tribal citizens based here in the area, or just anyone just living here?
Locals, the local community. You know, it was just them. But since we've been here all these years now, they've grown to love us.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, it was hard, you know. They didn't want to share the fishery.
And they don't understand either.
No.
They don't understand the rights. And
the treaty rights.
Treaty rights and none of that.
Mm-hmm. Now they understand.
Now they understand.
But they're very supportive of us. Mm-hmm.
What do you feel like folks understand now that they didn't in the beginning?
Well, that you can't just go in and just fish and fish and fish and take whatever you want and do whatever you want. That there is rules and limits and things
highly
that we have
regulated.
To follow. It's regulated.
We're highly regulated, yeah. So we can't just fish.
They thought at first they could just go out there and
take as much
fish of whatever they
unlimited.
Want.
You know, and you can't.
No.
Yeah. The Petersons fish just a couple miles offshore. On a busy day, they can move through 1,000 pounds of fish. Almost all the whitefish being sold in the area comes from Petersons, so they need every pound they can get.
and they work with biologists who study the fish population.
The only time we can't fish is November 6th through the 28th. That's when the fish are spawning, so we got to leave them alone. Well, this is closed down, the restaurant. So we just freeze up fish in advance, and we sell frozen fish for that month. And people come and buy it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only frozen for, you know, a couple weeks at the most. So they'll come and purchase it, so it's still fresh.
And does that mean you guys are fishing in December?
The fishermen go out year-round. They go out all year-round.
Year-round.
When it's 20 below and windy and frozen, they are out there fishing. It's not a fun job.
No, it's
hard. It's rough. People always say, oh, I'd love to go on your boat one day with us.
No.
And her husband's like, sure you would.
What is your signature or folks' favorite way that you prepare whitefish here?
Well, the fried.
Fried is probably
our signature
one, because that's what we started with, and we just did fried fish and just regular baked fish. But now, since then, we added hers. She'll go, oh, I hate making that, but it was her recipe, the Parmesan encrusted whitefish.
Oh, that is so
baked.
Good.
Baked. So that is a super popular. And then the Singapore whitefish, and it's a red spicy sauce on it. Very good. So those have gotten equally popular now.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Good. Oh, it smells so good back here.
Back in the kitchen, Tammy moves quickly between the fryer, the oven, and the fridge. The smell of sizzling fish in the fryers and the sound of whirling fans fills the air. Okay, can you tell us what you're doing?
I am frying up some whitefish and frying up some cod and french fries for a customer.
Where do you do all the fish prep, like the cleaning, descaling?
All that's done inside. They scale all the fish and fillet it for us and bring it out here for us, and then we just have it in the back, and we bread it in the back and everything.
Can you tell us the breading ingredients?
There is oregano, onion powder, garlic powder, paprika, and breading.
How long do you fry for?
Till I know it's done.
You're looking for like browning, the golden brown?
Yeah. I've been doing it so long that I can just look at it and I know when it's done. Mm-hmm. So thinner pieces like this are just a couple minutes. And these people that we're frying up for our regulars, they come practically every day. So they usually don't come this early, but they said they have something to do and they didn't want to miss their meal.
My co-producer April Van Buren and I sat down to taste.
Let's go try it.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Okay, I'm going to try the fried. That's so good. Crispy. Mm-hmm. Really crispy. Yeah, really fresh. I've never had fish this fresh. I don't know that I've had white fish, but this is very good. Really juicy. This is amazing. Good breading too. Not too salty. Subtle. Like you can really taste the fish. Really meaty. You try.
Okay. Try the... I gotta get some tartar sauce because that looked great.
Oh my god, it's so good. It's so flavorful, like the fish itself. Mm-hmm. It's not like, the breading doesn't like overwhelm it at all, and just gives that like nice crunch and a little bit, but the fish itself is so good, the fish flavor.
I've never had white fish that tasted like that.
Everything here is homemade, from the tartar sauce, to the salsa, to the smoked fish chowder. I could eat that all day. That's so good.
So the broth is made fresh from the fish, you know, leftovers. So that's where you get a lot of the flavor.
So you use everything?
We use everything, yeah.
Use the whole fish. Mm-hmm. Really flavorful. This one's a little spicier.
So it's got corn in it.
Corn, potato.
Potatoes.
What's on top?
Onion.
Ooh. It's a jalapeno emulsion. It's made out of jalapenos, garlic comfy, oil, honey mustard. Yeah, pretty much it.
It's good. I taste it. The restaurant is cash and carry out only, though there are tables inside and outside where you can sit and enjoy your fish. And some customers love the Peterson's whitefish so much, they found ways to get their fix year-round.
You know, I have a doctor in Chicago who orders every month. He'll order, you know, gosh, 30 fillets of whitefish frozen or whatever we got. Yeah. And, you know, so we have several people that order like that and ship it out. I said, you can't get any good fish in Chicago? He goes, no, it's about a week old when we get it. And that's the thing about fish. You got to have it fresh, you know.
I know Lake Superior is the only lake now where the whitefish aren't in danger with the zebra mussel population. Well, I know in the other four lakes.
Yeah.
Do you worry about that? Are you seeing signs of that? Yeah.
I was interviewed by a lady who was doing an article on the mussels of Lake Superior, you know. And they have some over by Isle Royal over there. They were manually removing them from the rocks and from the docks and stuff. They dive down and remove them. She said it isn't like a lot of them, but they're there. But it's either the too much calcium or too little calcium in Lake Superior.
Too much.
That keeps them kind of at bay so far. But now I talked to a biologist the other day, too, and he said, well, these species can adapt. You know, they can change like any species can adapt to their environment, he says, and hopefully they won't start, you know, growing because of that, changing, you know, that they don't need as much of that or something, you know. So it's something to worry about because it's put the Michigan fisheries right out of business, totally, because we know a lot of fishermen that mm-hmm. are done.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you guys in touch with other tribal commercial fishermen?
It's not even tribal. It's tribal, state, everyone. You know, everyone, yeah. Because you fishermen know everyone up and down the lakes. You just know them, you know. But it's, yeah, they're out of business. You know, it's sad.
Yeah. You know?
Do your fishermen know anything about noticing a population change in the past couple of years?
Of the fish? Well, our biologists study the fish extensively. So they're always telling us, you know, you're going to have a good class of fish coming up, you know, like last year. And we did. I mean, they check the growth. They know if you're going to have an overabundance or if it's going to be, you know, less. And they all checked, and they said, you're going to have a good year for 2 years, for sure.
Because the new class is coming.
Yeah, because we did last year, and we are this year, too. We're nailing them, you know. So, it's good.
Ask any of the three Petersons what the best part of the job is.
The people, I would say.
The people.
Yeah. The people.
I just told them this year that I feel like I'm too old, and I'm too tired to work all these hours, but then you come and you hang out with them and it's fun. And all the people, we laugh all day long and pick at each other.
But yeah.
Do you have a lot of regulars coming in?
Lots of regulars, yeah.
And I told her, I get like choked up when I look out and people are all sitting out eating, enjoying their food, and then
they're taking pictures of their food and posting
their food, and like somebody will be sitting and then somebody else will come in and they'll go up and hug them, oh, how are you, and they all like gather here and gather and eat,
and then they stick their heads in the window and they, hi Tammy's, you know, to me and her, because her and I do most of the cooking, so we're at the other end and we don't see the people that much other than out the window, but they stick in and say, hi Tammy's, it was great as always, and it makes it, I guess, worthwhile. All the long hours we put in.
We'll be working all day and evening, and I'll get choked up and I go, oh my god, look at all those people, they're just having a good time eating, and she's like, oh, shut up already. I'm tired.
The community the Petersons have built and the delicious meals that they're sharing with them all traces back to Lake Superior. What have you learned from being on the water for so many years?
What have I learned? I don't know.
Respect the water.
Yeah, respect Lake Superior. And I don't know what I've learned from that. Just, it's hard work, you know. You have to persevere through rough times, and you go out there and get, if you get 1,000 pounds, you're good. If you get 300 pounds, that's good too, you know. But you just respect, I guess.
Thankful for what you got.
Yeah.
Get.
That's what, mm-hmm. Thankful.
If you're hungry for more, listen and subscribe to The Dish wherever you get your podcasts.
That wraps it up for Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you for listening. Take care of yourself, and we'll see you Monday.